From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It was 2013 that Dr. William Johnstone came to work as a professor in the obstetrics and gynecology residency program at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. It didn't take long for him to see the devastating consequences from the opioid epidemic firsthand, although back then, the community was not yet talking about it. One hospital administrator tells us the number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome went from about 35 in 2010 to between 120 to 140 by 2016. Officials expect those numbers to continue rising. The local increases parallel the trends in both the state and the country. According to North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, one out of 100 babies born suffer from neonatal abstinence syndrome. The National Institute on Drug Abuse reports a fivefold increase in maternal opioid dependency and neonatal abstinence syndrome since 2000. For those reasons, Dr. Johnstone is trying a new approach. He, along with other local medical professionals, has started Tides, Inc., a very new nonprofit, just got its status a day or so ago. This nonprofit will support pregnant mothers with opioid dependencies. We will learn more about this organization today and its treatment protocol, including why Dr. Johnstone thinks it's critically important to have options beyond short-term abstinence-based rehabilitation. We'll also learn about the trends he's seeing in the local community. Dr. William Johnstone, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. And we're inviting you, of course, to join the conversation. What supports do you think authorities should consider for pregnant women with opioid dependencies? Have you suffered from this kind of addiction while pregnant? What got you through it? Are you still battling one? You can reach us on this Thursday and tell us about it at 910-343-1138 or at coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Johnstone, you've said that you felt you got really tuned into the depth and breadth of this crisis several years before the media caught on and before the community was talking about it. Tell us about coming here in 2013 and what you started to see in pregnant women.
My duties as a professor have me supervise labor and delivery in the residence care of patients and triage and antepartum and labor and delivery. And I was surprised at the number of women that we encountered, mainly on the antepartum floor, that were seeking help. Some in withdrawal, some trying to get placement in a long-term facility that we kept housed for days to weeks. And lots of times the disposition of those patients seemed to me uncertain. This was something that
You're talking about what might happen to them after they leave.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Especially after we handed them off. We kind of didn't have a sense of their success or whether they followed through with the program or not. And it seemed a little haphazard to me just because it was a startling new finding for me personally.
I think you were not seeing this level of abuse or dependency when you had come from Pinehurst.
That's correct.
This was completely new.
That's correct. I mean, it was there, but not to the point where the acute care of these patients was in my lap and right in front of us, and we were seeing the effects of these, the social effects that these women were suffering with that have opioid use disorder and were pregnant.
Now, how obvious is it when a pregnant woman comes into New Hanover Regional Medical Center? Is that something, I mean, if I'm pregnant and I come in for delivery, is it obvious that I need to be tested for illegal drugs, or do you test all pregnant women for drugs? How is that diagnosed in the first place?
Typically, we can recognize it. We do rely on the drug screen a lot if there's suspicion, because that is the one true determining test that will alert county authorities, child placement services, DSS to do an assessment on whether or not there needs to be an intervention to, you know, take that baby from the home for its safety.
What kinds of symptoms or observations would you make that would make you say, we need to test for opioids?
Social history. You can tell lots of times just by their abstinence leads them into early withdrawal, different types of behavior.
And what does that look like?
Withdrawal is not a pretty condition. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. Sweating, nausea, anxiety, joint pain, chills, fever, diarrhea, headache, it runs the gamut. And it's pretty intense. But it's part of the problem that being dependent on the use of opioids, your body becomes tolerant to it at first. Then you have to use more to get whatever effect you get from it. And then when you try to stop, there's the body's physical need for that particular chemical in the brain. And when it doesn't get it, then these symptoms manifest themselves. And having witnessed it a few times, it's with these women, it's not something that you'd wish on anyone.
So let's say that a woman comes in and starts experiencing withdrawal. You recognize it. She tests positive for illicit drugs. What's going to happen to her baby? Is there an established protocol for this?
There are state regulations. The problem with the code, in my opinion, is rather ambiguous, and each county can define what it means to be able to discharge a patient or a baby to a safe environment. That's what the code says. And some counties are loose, some are tight on their definition of safe, and it just depends on where you are.
So it's a judgment call for the people, the providers, basically, around the woman.
A judgment call on the county Department of Social Services and Child Placement Services, how they interpret the rule. And you know, the higher the bar they set, I mean, the more babies are removed from their mother's care into foster care or into kinship care. And we know those babies are safe because if you discharge a baby to a foster home, they've been vetted
right,
completely and extensively. We know they're safe. But at the same time, removing a baby from a mother's arms in care and breastfeeding is, you know, it can have a long-term effect on the fetus. So our goal within safety guidelines is to keep the mother-baby dyad intact.
And we're going to talk more in a moment about why that's important to you. You've mentioned breastfeeding, but if I'm addicted to illegal drugs, can I breastfeed my baby? Is that safe?
We'd rather get you on medically assisted therapy and have you breastfeed at that point. That can be done prenatally and during the time that you're carrying your fetus, so that when it's time to breastfeed, it's safe. You can use these medically assisted medications. The medications are deactivated when you swallow them, and so if it's secreted in the breast milk, baby swallows it, does not get the effect. So these medications have to be absorbed sublingually or under the tongue to get into the bloodstream quicker. If they're swallowed, has no effect whatsoever. So it does not affect the fetus.
I know that we're going to have some listeners who are listening to this and thinking, I'm not sure if I was king of the world that I would want to keep a baby with a woman who was addicted to illicit drugs and who's struggling with basic necessities in life. Maybe it would be better for that baby to go and be in foster care. How do you, or how do county officials make that call?
Right, and I don't disagree with that at all. That's not our intent. What the optimum patient is to have her enrolled either before she gets pregnant or soon after she gets pregnant into our program.
And you're talking about Tides, Inc., this new nonprofit you just launched.
Yes, I am. And successfully complete it. Now, this is not a 28-day program. It's not a two-month program. It's not a three-month program. It's forever how long it takes that patient to get on her feet, successfully complete, and show DSS and Child Placement Services that she can be a responsible mother. She can maintain a home. She can get a job. She can stay on her medically assisted therapy. And it's a chance for her to prove herself, to be able to be discharged with her baby. And they want a period of 5 to 6 months under our care as evidence that there is a change and that she's being successful in her treatment program. And then she can be discharged into our residential units that are supervised and considered to be safe for mom and baby to go home together. But again, I don't want anyone to think that we're trying to push babies home with women that are not ready or not capable of doing that yet.
And when we come back from this break, I want to get a little bit more into trauma theory and what medical professionals think about the mother-baby dyad and why that's so important to keep it intact if possible. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're learning today how the opioid epidemic that we hear so much about is impacting pregnant women and their babies. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Dr. William Johnstone, professor of the OBGYN residency program at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. When we come back from this break, we'll take some of your questions. You can reach us during this live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can email us as well at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're taking a look today at the opioid epidemic in the Cape Fear region in a slightly different way. As the number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome rises because more pregnant women are addicted to opioids, the medical community is looking for alternative ways to solve the problem. Dr. William Johnstone is professor of the Obstetrics and Gynecology Residency Program at New Hanover Regional Medical Center, and he's just launched a new organization called Tides, Inc., to do just that, offer an alternative. He is answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or via email at coastline@whqr.org. Let's just talk about trauma theory a little bit and how babies can be impacted both while they're infants and then down the road as they get older, if that mother-baby dyad is broken up?
Well, first off, the mother herself is a victim of the trauma-informed care theory, which is pretty simple and it's pretty obvious until you start thinking about it, and then it becomes something big. But what it believes in is that these women, roughly 80% of them, especially those that have an opioid use disorder, have experienced some form of trauma in their life. Okay, so maybe their mom was had opioid use disorder. She saw her mom overdose as a 4-year-old or 5-year-old. A lot of these women are physically abused, mentally abused, and sexually abused. Some of them are in the sex trafficking business to support their habit. They live trauma every day. Separation, babies taken away from them in the past, not knowing where their next meal is going to come from, not knowing where they're going to sleep. And so the basis of the trauma-informed care, which is the backbone of the theories that we're using to form TIDES, is to put these women in a safe environment, something that they can find that's consistently safe for her, her children, her new child, in a non-judgmental environment by staff and providers. A key component to the trauma-informed care is peer support, which is something that we'll have in our program, peer-to-peer counseling. Someone that has been in her shoes before, that has successfully recovered and can help them walk hand in hand through the process so they're not alone. Give them a voice, empower them to make decisions, hopefully the right ones, to support their decisions, to focus on the positives, not necessarily their faults. We all have faults, but sometimes we see their faults as bigger than their successes. But if they're just there talking to us about embarking on recovery, that's a positive. And you got to take that opportunity to make it a positive and show them, look what you've done. Look what you just did. You did something that, you know, is maybe the turning point. Another thing is, which we sometimes take for granted, but it can really impact these patients and these women, is cultural differences, racial differences, ethnic differences.
How does that impact women here?
Well, I mean, the stereotype of, I hate to use the word addict because that's just, it's not the nomenclature we use, but that's what you hear, is how we feel like that we can identify these people, and we have prejudices towards them. And I mean, it's just part of society and how we see each other and view each other. And that has to be erased, because we want an environment where anyone can feel comfortable and feel safe. One of the components or arms of our treatment is a spiritual component, not necessarily that we're going to load everybody up on the bus every Sunday and go to church, but
is it a Christian-based orientation?
Not necessarily. No, if you have beliefs other than the Christian belief, then that's going to be accepted. And we
But this
will,
is along the lines of like the 12-step, a higher power.
A higher power. Yeah, you've got to have an understanding that there is a higher power, and because if you believe in a higher power, then everybody has a purpose, and you've got to find out what your purpose is. So no matter what your religious beliefs are, they'll be supported
and accepted. That component as an integral part of the healing process.
For sure.
Finding one's purpose.
No doubt. We're modeling our program after a very successful program in Chapel Hill called Horizons. It's been around for 26 years. It started as a campaign promise from Governor Jim Hunt when he was running for one of his terms. I think he had four of them. But at that time, it was the crack baby that was the big social issue, and he made it part of his platform that if he was elected, that he was going to do something about that. And so he was elected and had the legislature fund a grant, and John Thorpe, who's a maternal-fetal medicine doctor at UNC and a colleague of mine and friend of mine and actually on our board, applied for the grant, and he got it. And so 26 years later, after he started in a closet as an office with one employee, he's now has about 90 employees. And, of course, the drug of choice has changed, and so his treatment has evolved. But it's a well-recognized program. And the components of their program we are mimicking, and one of them is the spiritual arm of the treatment program. But I don't have the luxury, and this community does not have the luxury, of 26 years to go from where he started and take the time to get to where he is now. So for that reason, I've chosen to go out into the community and identify agencies that are already providing or doing the arms of our treatment spoke of the wheel type.
You're not creating this from scratch.
Exactly.
You're bringing together the providers and creating this network.
Correct. I call it a collaborative consortium with the same goal, but everybody working together. And eventually in 26 years, we may have all these services under one roof. But for something that's needed immediately, this was the quickest way to get it up and going.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the opioid epidemic locally through the eyes of a local OBGYN who sees moms and new babies battle the vagaries of addiction on a regular basis. Dr. William Johnstone is our guest today. He's professor of the OBGYN residency program at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. He's just launched a nonprofit organization to deal with women who are addicted to opioids, and he's answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm noticing that you're using this term, opioid use disorder, and I imagine that is part of an effort to destigmatize opioid addiction. Talk about the importance of that. Why does that matter?
Addiction carries a connotation with it that is sometimes hard to identify, but it's stereotypical. And, you know, you don't have to look far in the film industry or even television to imagine the role of an addict and what it would look like. And fortunately, that is not always true. You may be working with an addict you would not know had an opioid use disorder problem. And you know the DSM definition of addiction carries with it some rather negative behaviors. And so in an attempt to destigmatize using your word, The term opioid use disorder has been settled upon by a lot of the addiction modalities, treatment modalities, and programs around the country as a term that is not as stereotypical.
You've said that the first half of 2017 saw more patients needing child placement services than the whole of 2016. And you've said that it's not getting better. The numbers are climbing. And you've also just said that we may not recognize someone who is addicted to opioids. What is the face of opioid addiction in this community? Is there a particular demographic that's harder hit?
Until recently, the face of the person with opioid use disorder was a white male using opiates. In the last couple of years, it's still about equal so far as males and females go, but women have overtaken men by just a couple of percentage points so far as people with opioid use disorder in actually the state. And they're using opiates, but heroin is not far behind.
We have an email from Ellen. She writes, can you speak to the infant's symptoms and recovery time following birth with the mother of opioid addiction? So I assume she's talking about a baby who's been diagnosed with neonatal abstinence syndrome. What are the symptoms for a baby?
They're difficult to console. They have tremors, very jittery, like they're hard to fall asleep. And if they do, and if you bump into their crib or their bassinet, they'll jump and respond, you know, almost a hyper response. They have difficulty feeding and suckling. They have the same symptoms that an adult would have. It's just they can't tell you about it, so you have to recognize it and see it. And it's not too hard to recognize.
Is it a given that a pregnant woman who is suffering from opioid use disorder, I'm going to get used to that term, is it a given that her baby will have neonatal abstinence syndrome?
It varies in intensity from patient to patient. Some babies have a mild withdrawal or neonatal abstinence syndrome. Some it starts while they're in the hospital, while mom's still an inpatient. Others it takes days to a week after they get back home. It's not recognized until then. But they do not all have full-blown manifested neonatal abstinence syndrome, but it's highly likely that they will. The mothers that are treated with medically assisted therapy during their pregnancy, and I'm speaking of Suboxone, which is buprenorphine and naloxone, and buprenorphine alone, those babies experience about half the time in the neonatal intensive care unit, and they experience and use about 50% of the morphine required to alleviate their symptoms. So their course of neonatal abstinence syndrome is abbreviated.
So you are treating these babies with medicine. What's the difference between methadone, which has been used to treat heroin withdrawal for decades, and some of these newer drugs like naloxone?
Right. Naloxone is a blocker. It blocks the mu receptor so that if someone has received a potent dose of heroin, the receptor is filled with the naloxone. And so no more of the active ingredient in the heroin can hit that receptor. But we combine that with buprenorphine, which is was initially made as a and manufactured and sold as a pain medication 25, 30 years ago. And then we saw that it was what we call a partial agonist. It will touch the mu receptor and can give the patient pain relief if administered more frequently, but also can allay the withdrawal symptoms
pretty successfully. Those intense flu-like symptoms that you've described.
Yes, if administered once, sometimes twice a day. So those are the medications of choice that we use now for treating opioid use disorder. The methadone is still used and sometimes required. The differences are that methadone has to be picked up at a clinic on a daily basis. It cannot be prescribed and you go pick up a month's supply and take it home. The Subutex, which is this buprenorphine, or the Suboxone, which is buprenorphine and naloxone, can be prescribed by a physician that has a waiver, which means they've gone through a course on how to administer this drug.
Do people get high from methadone and these newer drugs?
The problem is that the euphoria they get or used to get when they started their path down the opioid use disorder pathway, initially it felt really good. And it was a fun thing to do. But as time goes on and you develop the tolerance, then the biggest thing is treating the withdrawal symptoms. And in the deepest throes of opioid use disorder / addiction, it's mainly not to get the euphoria. And so these medications do not produce a euphoric type of feeling in the body. It takes away the withdrawal symptoms that can be so devastating and serious.
Why is medically assisted therapy controversial in some circles? I mean, we've heard people who are against medically assisted therapy say you're just replacing an illicit drug with a legal drug. You're not actually solving the problem, the underlying problem.
Right. And you're talking to one of those people right now. In 2013, that was how this program was going to work, was abstinence. And as I told you before, I'm a pelvic floor surgeon. I'm a vaginal surgeon. I have other duties of obstetrician and gynecologist because I'm a teacher. But I've had to educate myself, and I've had to intensely educate myself on the science of addiction. And this program, TIDES, is based on evidence-based medicine. We have years of studies that show that medically assisted therapy is the most successful way of a sustained recovery, and that abstinence in a 28-day program, while good, and it does stick sometimes, but they're quoted failure rates of as high as 96%.
96% failure rate with abstinence-based therapy.
Yes.
And also a shorter program.
Correct. Now, there are other, you know, 6 months abstinence programs, but they're rare. But the run-of-the-mill treatment program of 28 days and abstinence is compared to medically assisted therapy is just not that successful.
Now, if you are treating a woman with some of those newer drugs that you've talked about through medically assisted therapy, is there a point when you take her off those drugs and start working on some of the, I mean, you're probably always working on the psychology and some of the past trauma issues that she's had, but does that ever go away?
It can. It's not recommended very soon after starting or even within a year or two. But at some point, if the patient comes to me and says, you know, I've done this and I've done that, I've done this successfully, I'm feeling good about myself, I'd like to wean off this medically assisted therapy. I'm not so sure I'd be comfortable with it because it's you have to look at addiction as a lifelong disease.
Do you think people should be on these drugs for the rest of their lives, ideally?
I think to be successful, it's a long-term therapy, yes.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a closer look today at the problem of pregnant women and mothers suffering from opioid use disorder. We're talking with OBGYN William Johnstone. When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to reach us on this Thursday with your question or comment. The phone number is 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're learning about a new nonprofit organization called TIDES, Inc., launched by Dr. William Johnstone, professor of the OBGYN residency program at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. He launched TIDES, Inc. in answer to the spike in pregnant women and mothers suffering from opioid use disorder in the area. He says he saw the disturbing evidence that this was an epidemic several years before the media and the rest of the community started talking about it. And he's answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us by phone at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few more minutes to get your question in. Dr. Johnstone, just before we went to break, you were explaining why you think a woman who is on medically assisted therapy for opioid use disorder probably needs to consider staying on that kind of medically assisted therapy for the long term, possibly even her lifetime. That sounds sort of bleak, like it's a disease that you never really conquer. But you've also in the past compared this opioid use disorder to hypertension or diabetes. Tell us about that analogy.
Yeah, it was one of the things I had to learn myself because it seemed to me like starting the road to addiction or opioid use disorder was a choice that someone made, as opposed to I think I'm going to get hypertension today and start on some medication, you know. But once you understand the science of addiction and opioid use disorder, the chemical changes in the brain, especially the pleasure center and dopamine, which is the neurotransmitter that is increased when we have pleasure, when we see a movie, when we see a stunning video game, when we do opioids, the dopamine rises in the pleasure center. And the more you use opioids, the more you have that rise in the dopamine, the more your brain changes. It's rewired, for lack of a better word. I'm not a neurologist, but the brain is reconfigured, and it changes. And so that's the effect. Now, the disease didn't start when someone made a choice to start using whatever. The disease started after the brain got used to this dopamine and was, for lack of a better word, rewired. That's when the disease process starts. And you can't go back to the way it was when you started the use of opioids. So that's when the disease starts. And for that brain to be able to carry on its normal functions, it's got to have that pulse of stimulation there, albeit minor. And that's why the theory of long-term medically assisted therapy is the current scientific evidence-based way to treat this disease and to make sure that someone is successful for the long term. Because we don't just want these patients finish a 28-day program and then go back to the same habits they had before. We want that person, even if they go to a 28-day program, to decide to make a change. And then you've got to have long-term therapy to give them the tools to make that change.
Is this part of your understanding of this? Is it part of why you seem to have so much compassion? I mean, was there ever a time that you would look at a woman who would come in, obviously addicted to opioids or illicit drugs, and just get frustrated with her or look down on her or judge her decisions? I'm asking you to be really honest here.
Yes, I did. I mean, honestly, I did. And couldn't for the life of me understand how that could happen. But an event in 2017 really impacted me. And our whole program, actually. And
can you tell us about that event?
Well, we had a patient that was admitted, later diagnosed with a very serious heart condition and delivered and subsequently died. And she was a young lady, very young lady, young mother. And it really impacted a lot of us, and it kind of fueled the passion that I have for this.
Why do you think that this young woman's death impacted you and other medical professionals so deeply? Was she in your care for a while, or?
She was in our care for a while, and a lot of specialist care for a while. It was something that you hear about and you read about it, but you don't come face to face with it, thank God, often. But just to understand what it does to a family and what it does to a baby that doesn't have a mom,
or a mother
that doesn't have a daughter.
Where did the baby go?
I'm not sure, but I believe it's in kinship. So the media blitz about it, and I think it's great. We're all talking about it and getting the word out and not putting our head in the sand anymore. But at the same time, we can sit around and talk about it all we want to. We have to do something. And our program is an action plan that has several facets to it. And the backbone of it, as I mentioned before, is the trauma-informed care. But the The two main spokes of the wheel are medically assisted therapy and an intense counseling. Obviously, the prenatal care is there. We'll have centering pregnancy for these women. We'll have the peer-to-peer counseling. It'll have a residential component for women that will require housing. Approximately 30 to 40% of the women that we'll have in the program will need housing because they're on the street, in the back of a car, on someone's sofa. They don't have a place to go. We will provide child care for these women and their children, transportation, and teach them life skills, how to balance a checkbook, how to take care of an apartment, how to pay your bills, parenting skills.
Now, this is sort of a phased-in program. You will eventually have a lot more patients, but you've already started with your first patient.
Correct. We've got three patients in the program now.
You have three now.
Yes.
So can you tell us about one of them? What her, of course, respecting her privacy and not using her name, but just giving us the circumstances of her case.
Right. She was sent to us after asking for help, and she is in a stable home environment, works, has transportation. So she was the perfect choice to get into the skeleton of our program, to kind of walk through the steps of the program to see where we need to shore it up a little bit, tighten it up, and
kind of the beta test.
Exactly. And she's done rather well. She's taught us a lot. And I
how long has she been in now?
She's been in about 15 weeks.
Okay.
And so.
And what have you learned from her? What's working?
Well, you know, when I you asked me the question about being judgmental about these patients, and honestly, I was. But when you sit down and talk to these young women and hear their stories, it's a lesson that we're all different. We don't all have the benefit of a good support system. And you can understand how they end up where they are. And she's not too much different than the rest of them. They have had some rough times in their lives. But hers started with an automobile accident and a broken bone in her body. And that's how she started down the path. And that is
dealing
very common.
Dealing with the pain from that auto accident.
Right. Initially, it was the pain. And it was treated, and it led to her pathway to opioid use disorder. So it's a common denominator for a lot of these patients.
You're listening to Coastline. We're looking at the opioid epidemic locally through the eyes of a local OBGYN, Dr. William Johnstone, who sees moms and new babies battle addiction on a regular basis. He's answering your questions on this Thursday. Just a few minutes left. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. What do women have to pay to be in this program? How are the costs covered for patients?
They don't have to pay anything. Their care will be covered, their prenatal care will be covered by whatever insurance they have. We accept Medicaid, which is the state-funded insurance.
Are there a lot of other programs, rehab programs, that accept Medicaid in the area? Are you thinking or reluctant to answer?
We accept Medicaid.
Okay.
And
okay.
All other insurers, but we will not charge for a place for her to live or transportation or daycare. Most of my energy in the last 10 months has been fundraising.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say that we've received money from New Hanover Regional Medical Center. We'll find out next month if our first year startup costs will be funded.
What is the budget for the first year?
Well, it's not cheap, but I'm not willing to share that figure right now. I mean, it'll be public because it's a nonprofit,
right.
So you know those figures will be. But we haven't really settled on a number yet, and so
it's sensitive. You're in the fundraising process,
right?
So,
and yeah. We're in an approval process for one source, and so I don't want to jeopardize that by saying a number and then wanting more.
But that's fair. Okay. Well, we'll have to follow up with you on that.
Yes.
You've put together a board of directors.
Correct.
Can you share the identities of some of those folks? Who's involved in this?
I'm glad you asked because you said a lot about me doing this and me doing that, but there are a lot of people. My colleagues, my fellow faculty members, we all recognize it was a problem. It was just not my revelation. But there have been a lot of people that have helped and have been interested. We have 5 dedicated volunteers that heard about it and came to me and said, "What can I do?" They each had their own area of expertise and complement each other very well. And since bringing on my first volunteer, say back in October, the momentum has just really picked up. And we've started moving to the point where we're getting to that we're going to have to quit talking about what we're doing and really actually doing it. It's kind of a little scary, but exciting at the same time. Our board, there are a lot of mainly local people involved. I mentioned John Thorpe, who's a maternal fetal medicine doctor at UNC that started the Horizons program. He's been very kind to sit on our board, hopefully for a short term. I have legal representatives, business representatives, physicians, other nonprofit leaders. I didn't tell them I was going to call them by name, but
so you're not ready to do that.
I'm not ready to do that. But again, it's a public entity, and their names are listed on the North Carolina Secretary of State's website. And you would recognize these people, but they've committed to meet 4 times a year, and they're very good at what they do, and I appreciate their time and dedication to this cause.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Let's say that I've heard this program. I am suffering from opioid use disorder, and I'm pregnant, and I would like to get into TIDES. What are the criteria, and how can I go about getting help?
The resident OB clinic is at 2150 Shipyard. That's where you'd be seen if you were in the program, and I suggest you give that clinic a call or show up. Mm-hmm. They can find me, I promise you. I know they can. We have a website. It's www.tideswilmington.org, and there's a telephone number there. If you'd like to give us a call, everything is confidential, just like you were going to your physician.
And what would make you decide that you would take my case and you would accept me into the TIDES program?
Our program is mainly focused for women who are pregnant, who are anticipating pregnancy, or immediately postpartum. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist, and I.
And that's really the biggest. That's the criteria.
That's the criteria.
The rest of it doesn't matter. My finances or lack thereof.
Correct. Does not matter. You can qualify if you're pregnant in the state. You can qualify for pregnancy Medicaid. So that's something we'd like for you to enroll in. But other than that, we've got it for you.
And we will put that information on our website. That's this edition of Coastline. Dr. Johnstone, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. Or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.